It's the show Agent Orange / Adolf Twitler would love to shut down.
So here's the story, folks. I am the least black person that you've ever seen in your entire life. In fact, we did very well relative to racist people.
It's the no bullshit zone.
It's called fake news.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
I know who you are. Just wait.
On the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. How's it going? Boy, do we have a lot to cover today, including another tragedy in school shootings, an abortion law that is a tragedy unto itself, tax returns and secret visits and sex cults. It's going to be a really fun show. Taking you through that journey is, well, me, your host, critical thinker, problem solver, guy just left of normal and sane and always centered in common sense. My name is Shaggy Jenkins, and I can always be found at my website, shaggyjenkins.com, or wherever fine social media is served, at Shaggy Live. I begin today, sadly, with the reports of another mass shooting, this one taking place in one of the suburbs of Denver at a STEM school. That's science, technology, I can't remember all of it. Engineering, mathematics, I believe. Gosh, I feel so bad for not knowing that. But it's one of these schools that's in Highlands Ranch, okay? Around 1:50 today, the scene kind of unfolded where, and I know that this is kind of one of those things that is becoming commonplace in America, school shootings, right? I know that because just a day before this happened, on Monday, we were actually kind of looking over news stories of two students from Ohio that got suspended and possibly facing charges for their role in calling a mass shooting or active shooting hoax into their school to get the day off. Now, that's how commonplace it is. The lockdown happened, the students didn't go to school, and of course, once the hoax was discovered in Ohio, those two students are now facing not only charges, but are suspended. When it comes to the Colorado story, once again, we have two people entering a scene in a school in Colorado and, well, trying to create mass havoc. Now, not a lot is known of the story at the time, but police have said that they have arrested, or should I say the sheriffs, have arrested what seems to be an adult male and an adolescent, and they confiscated guns. Of course, they're in the process of going through the normal warrants and stuff, and it's kind of crazy when you think about it. But in your high school life, remember when you were in high school? It wasn't that long ago for a lot of us, and in those days, way back before, I don't know, 1999 happened, having a shooter lockdown, an active shooter scenario, school drills, and things like that did not exist. We lived in a world without that kind of inherent fear when it comes to going into to school. But instead, now, where we stand, we have two people going into a school, shooting. And in this case right now, out of the eight people that were injured in the gunfire, one of them has passed, a student who authorities have not released the name. His family has been notified, but it's going to be a very sad day in Colorado once again. And here's the thing. We've already seen the normal reactions, thoughts and prayers, but we've not seen any sort of meaningful action where, and I know this is one of those dare to dream with me moments, but where we can live in a world where we don't have to have active shooting kind of drills for these students because they'll live in a world without the fear of that happening anymore because we will have meaningfully done something about guns and regulating them in this country or outright banning them like other countries did and haven't had mass shootings. I'm just throwing that out there, you know. But when it comes to the Colorado story, the thing is that if you add up the one student that passed away from that and the other students that since the year, I don't know, 2017, if you add up all of those students, they actually dead students now, dead United States students not serving in an active war environment, outnumber service members killed in active war zones during those same time periods. That is something that is very scary, because if you go back all the way to the early years of, I don't know, the early aughts, 2010, if we're at 2010 and we're looking at data of people killed in shooting events as far as being a member of the armed services and shooting events that happen domestically as students at high schools, and we see that the students outnumber the soldiers in deaths, it's kind of weird that we're still at this point of thoughts and prayers. Here's the thing, though, because in the hours to come, of course, the Colorado community of Highland Ranch and their STEM school is going to be going through a very, well, traumatic mourning experience. And it probably will be a while, especially in a state like Colorado, which is, I hate to say it, but notorious for being the founding places, thanks to Columbine's notoriety, of mass school shootings in America. Well, once again, the Colorado community is gripped with a terrible tragedy of a mass school shooting. And it's been 20 years. And on the 20th anniversary of something like Columbine that establishes the paradigm of school shootings becoming something that we just think are the norm here, so we give, you know, things like shooter drills. Like, I can understand fire drills. I can understand natural disaster drills. But we're talking about students here that really, if you look into how education is done these days, have a lot more to worry about than, well, being shot. And that's a terrible place to be. But that's exactly where we are. Thoughts and prayers again. Will action come? Probably not. Moving on, here's a kind of a story that is, well, it is indicative of how we treat anatomy here in the United States. Now, I want to give you kind of a comparison of genitalia. Because, believe it or not, as much as you don't think your own matters as to what you are, apparently to the law it does. I'm going to make a kind of comparison here between Georgia's new abortion law that just got signed into act yesterday and the way that we advertise towards men and their genitalia. When it comes to men and their genitalia, we have new websites set up so that men can just go there discreetly and get medication for things like erectile dysfunction. We have all of these many, many, many different commercials promoting sexual health in men, and it's all about how functioning their genitalia is. But when it comes to female genitalia in this country, it seems we're not all go, go, go. We're more no, 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 especially if you look at the trends of states across, I don't know, the last 5 years that have started enacting something called, just like Georgia's was, the Heartbeat Act. Okay, these heartbeat bills basically seek to make abortions illegal as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detectable. Now, that might sound like a very big and noble cause, but oh, God, this is going to be so uncomfortable for you to listen to, but it's a conversation that I have to have all the time when people bring up female reproductive rights around me. Because like I said, before I started this whole conversation about this heartbeat bill, when it comes to genitalia in this country, we are fascinated with giving men their virility and equally fascinated with taking away women's rights to their own anatomies. Now, when I bring up the heartbeat of a fetus, you have to understand there is something called viability, all right? Now, viability is, in very, very layman terms, the definition from a collection of loose cells and growing pieces into what is actually considered a thinking, living creature, okay? Viability usually happens in the human gestation period around 24 weeks of pregnancy. When is a heartbeat detectable? Well, remember how I said that it's a collection of cells, and these cells start to mimic functions of the body that eventually becomes a viable human embryo or fetus? Well, fetus is actually the definition. Okay, look, it gets very complicated. Get a dictionary for this section. Because when you say, okay, well, life begins at a heartbeat, you're not really being very accurate with how biology works. And that's very uncomfortable for a lot of people to hear. However, here's the thing. When you talk about what is a detectable heartbeat and when at such time is that heartbeat detectable, it's usually around 6 weeks of pregnancy. Okay, fun fact for you. When does a woman actually know she's pregnant? Guys in the audience, you're probably thinking immediately, or I don't know, I guess as soon as she misses her first period. You do not understand menstruation at all. Periods can change over time, over season, and thanks to environmental stimuli, especially work stress and nutrition, a woman's menstruation cycle, if not regulated through birth control pills, which are just basically simple hormones to regulate a cycle itself, without that kind of control, periods fluctuate all the time. All the time. So when you say, okay, well, a woman would know she's pregnant by the time she misses her first period, that's not factually correct. And if you're thinking, okay, well, then obviously she'll know as soon as the morning sickness kicks in, because that kicks in as soon as a woman is pregnant. As a matter of fact, we've seen all of the Hollywood films and everything that always show that picturesque pregnancy of the woman makes out with the guy, they go back to his place, and 2 days later she's throwing up in the toilet going, oh God, I must be pregnant. In human gestation, or the process of being pregnant, women don't experience morning sickness until week 9. So if you're thinking of, well, they should know they're pregnant before a heartbeat begins. One, it's not a heart, it's a collection of cells mimicking the function of a heart. And two, 6 weeks and 9 weeks. And remember, that's at the earliest onset of morning sickness. Some women can make it up to 10 or 11 weeks before symptoms like a morning sickness even kicks in. So when you talk about these states that enact heartbeat bills, one, it's not a heart. Two, it's actually kind of sliding a woman's rights to choose by circumventing the amount of time you give her to realize if she's pregnant. Now, other states have kind of fallen into this suit lately of this big conservative push that was way back in the 2010s, starting out under the Obama administration. But this long push that's been happening has gained ground as of recent because of our president. Now, you're probably thinking, oh, yeah, here we go again. Donald Trump is responsible for everything. In this case, he is. And it has to do with the Supreme Court. You see, right before President Obama was to leave office, he put forth a judicial nominee for the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. We don't talk about that guy a whole lot because Mitch McConnell and Republicans stonewalled him for over 440 days until such time that there was a new election, a new president. That president was Trump. And of course, Trump went and pushed through Neil Gorsuch, When they put Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, they did that in a way that changed the fundamental laws of how the nomination process worked. In other words, they could put a judicial nominee on the Supreme Court with just a partisan vote without the opportunity for the minority party to filibuster. That was a fundamental shift that Republicans made just to put Neil Gorsuch on the bench. Now, that still left kind of an uneven platform, even with then-serving Justice Anton Scalia. Because Scalia was, yes, a conservative, but at the same time, tried to always look at things in a judicial context via a conservative lens, but he was a much more judicious judge. Then came the controversial nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. And Brett Kavanaugh, before going through that contentious testimony that he did, had a track record of being very, very far right of the political spectrum. And after Republicans were able to once again use the rules that they created themselves just to put Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, to once again put another justice up there in the guise of Brett Kavanaugh, states where these conservative heartbeat bill anti-female reproductive rights acts. Everybody says, oh, it's an anti-abortion act. Yeah, it is. But at the end of the day, isn't abortion about women's health? So isn't it, in fact, an act against women's reproductive health? It is. Look it up. But moving on, when it comes to these kind of acts, the precedent that is now set is that there is a very right-leaning Supreme Court willing to hear an anti-abortion case. And that's why states like Kentucky, Mississippi, even Ohio are in the same bandwagon of Georgia, of banning abortions after 6 weeks, before a woman can feasibly, through natural processes, realize she is in fact pregnant. Now, with that said, these cases and these bills are stacking up all across the more conservative red states and red counties of the United States. And with them, it's going to bring a litany of, well, litigation. And that's exactly what's happened with organizations like the ACLU and others jumping into the fray. Eventually, one of these cases will make it to the Supreme Court. And conservatives have done a very good job of making sure that that deck is stacked for the pro, or in this case, anti-women's reproductive states. Reproductive rights. Now, the United States has a long history of this. Back in 1900, every state had banned abortions entirely, all because during the 1800s, physicians who saw non-medical professionals kind of jumping into the abortion services as kind of a threat to their industry and also, let's just face it, realistically, harmful to women's health. So by 1900, they had all gathered together and banned abortions entirely. Now, the issue wouldn't come up again, especially in the war-torn United States, which lost massive amounts of its population to two world wars. We didn't really kind of get into caring any more about female reproductive rights until the 1960s. That's when women started once again advocating for their own reproductive rights. Now, Colorado, once again in headlines, changed its anti-abortion laws in 1967, and that was followed by California and New York and so on. We're not for women getting the choice. So the oldest group, which was the National Right to Life, was founded in 1968. And these groups are still pushing funding and a lot of momentum politically behind these efforts for heartbeat bills. Now, here's something that you should know. In 1973, the Supreme Court did in fact act Roe v. Wade. And that was basically when we were start to saying, you know what, there's this thing called viability. Remember that from the earlier part? Viability is, can this entity, this collection of cells, exist outside of its carrier creature? All right? Just like in most mammalian biology, can you be alive outside of the womb? And that was about third trimester, 28 weeks into pregnancy. So the movement over time has been, okay, well, since we can't actually repeal it, and let's not forget, Roe v. Wade isn't the real decision that controls female reproductive rights. It was actually another act that was done in the 1990s by the Supreme Court that currently says, hey, you know what? And I'm going to just paraphrase here. You could make it as hard as possible in your state for women to obtain abortions, but you can't ban it. That's basically what it amounts to. So with that said, where we stand now is in the United States, we have taken and taken and taken and taken from women's right to choose. And with these new acts pushing across more conservative states, it's only a matter of time before we end up in front of the Supreme Court. And when it comes to ending up in front of the Supreme Court, yeah, that could be a stacked deck that we are not prepared for. And that's kind of where we stand. Georgia being the latest state to act. And here's the thing. When Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed this law into act, it's called the Living Infants Fairness and Equality Act, or the LIFE Act. It's going to go into effect January 2020. But when he signed it in, he basically said that this is done to protect life, to protect females' lives, to protect, well, everybody. And the thing is that he's not really being honest about how reproduction works. But now, state legislators are following the example, especially emboldened now with Georgia joining the fray. And they're going to keep pushing and pushing and pushing back against females' right to choose in a realistic, medically safe, and confidential way. Keep in mind, some states might not ban the act of abortion, but they will say that you can't do it without the other person's consent. So once again, is that a right to choose, or is that a right to negotiate? You be the judge, because that's going to be the underlying argument with it. And in the future, we're going to see more and more restrictive rights trying to take away from women's ability to choose. And the more we take away from them, the less they're going to be able to get back in the long run. Remember, this will all eventually end up in front of a Supreme Court, because it is a stacked deck. And let's just face it. In a country where we've already made it hard to get income if you're a woman, there's the gender pay gap. Then there's the minority gender pay gap that makes a woman of color getting ahead in life. Ooh, that much more a struggle. I know what you're saying. Oh, what about Oprah? Ooh. One of these days, we've got to talk about lottery statistics and your chances of winning. But the thing is that time after time after time after time in America, we have sought to take away from women merely, and I cannot stress this enough, for being different than men. There is nothing wrong with being a woman. There is nothing Well, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. I don't know what other words I can say. But when we talk about a woman's choice, giving a woman a choice does seem to be, at least in this country right now, something that a lot of people are moving against, saying, no, women shouldn't have the right to choice. But way back when we established viability, when we had the whole discussion before that resulted in the first ever national hearing on abortion, Roe v. Wade, we actually got it kind of right. It just seems over the years we've been slowly trying to make it wrong again, especially if you're a woman. And let's face it, that's just sad. Coming back, we'll talk about the president's tax returns and the U.S. Attorney General. Is he facing contempt? I'll let you know. It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show.
Get informed. This is the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network.
It's the Shaggy Jenkins Show on the Pacifica Radio Network. Welcome back. Boy, did we cover a lot in the first segment, and if you missed it, look us up, Shaggy Jenkins Show on, well, anywhere you get podcasting, or just go to my website, shaggyjenkins.com, and you can find some stuff there. Hi, I am your host, and boy, let's talk about our Attorney General. Before we get into, well, a story that you're not going to believe in, well, a source that you probably will believe. Jerry Nadler is moving forward with a vote against Bill Barr. Now, on yesterday's program, when we talked about where the Supreme Court, where the House investigations into the Mueller report and getting a full unredacted copy provided to them stood, we had Nadler saying that he was going to go ahead with a vote. And I also pointed out that going ahead with a vote really doesn't amount to much. Okay, let's just be honest. A contempt charge, we've had attorney generals in the past ignore them. But if this should go judicial, there is something that is to be said for accommodations. Now, this is where the two parties, either through third-party mediation or, just coming to their senses and negotiating amongst themselves, basically concede to do something. Now, when that can't be, well, especially between governmental departments, when that can't be found in any sort of solution, no compromise, no concessions, no talking to each other, then it goes to court. And when it comes to trying somebody, especially somebody like an attorney general, you have to show from a legal standpoint that you sufficiently tried to accommodate their request. And that's exactly what Nadler did. Now, he entered into some 11th hour negotiations with the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice said that, look, okay, we won't do what you want us to do and we won't testify, but we will allow you to have a sneak peek at a less redacted report, and we can have a select number of senior lawmakers keep their handwritten notes on it. Maybe 12 members of Congress? But that's it. They didn't offer to include additional documents. They didn't say that people that would be able to see the document would be able to discuss it or even share their notes with colleagues. In other words, whoever sees it, and whatever they saw, they can't talk about it. Now, here's the thing. The Justice Department allowed each of the lawmakers to bring two staffers instead of one to view the less redacted version. That was like the 11:30th hour kind of negotiation. It would allow top Democrats and Republicans on the House and Senate Judiciary and Intelligence Committee, in addition to the House and Senate leaders of both parties, to view this less redacted version. But that's still not exactly what the House investigation was asking for. And as such, the contempt charge, according to Nadler, will go forward against Bill Barr. Boy, by the time we get to the weekend review, this is going to be a very interesting story to follow up on. Speaking of following up, let's talk about the New York Times. They've once again tried to go deep, deep, deep into the Trump financial firestorm, and, oh boy, did they dig up a lot. Here's the thing. Donald Trump, time and time and time again, has tried to keep his tax returns from reaching the public eye, citing audits, citing other reasons, citing privacy, citing political conspiracy, deep state conspiracy, whatevs. You know, whatever's beneficial to that day. But thanks to, once again, the careful and hard work of the weird, and I say weird because investigative journalism is a strange thing. And I say that from experience, because once you try to go into a story, you find yourself going down every twist and turn imaginable, and sometimes you arrive at something like this. Although they are a little old, there is now tax information that has been verified from the New York Times from 1985 to 1994 on Donald Trump. And contrary to the big narrative that he has spun about he was a self-made man, he got a tiny loan from his father, the tax laws are inherently wrong in the United States, and he was able to benefit from knowing how wrong these tax codes were. Oh, and he had a brief wealth kind of gap happen in the early 1990s that he blames on the recession. But on the up and up, as an author, as a company that basically went out there and said they were going to buy other companies to drum up support behind their own brand, it looks like Donald Trump was really not as rich as he claimed to be. And when I say not as rich, I'm talking billions in debt over the entire decade, if you add it up, okay? Because there's some pretty big numbers according to this these tax returns. Which, by the way, they're already trying to spin from the White House perspective. We'll get to that in a sec. But let's say that you had one operational year as Donald Trump. Now, there's part of his income that we can't really track, and that's stuff that he received from foreign investors or things that move through kind of backdoor channels. But the stuff that he actually has on his IRS transcripts and his filings from 1040s, his own returns, and returns obtained through other investigations. Oh, and remember that whole tax dodging investigation from the New York Times behind Fred and Donald Trump? They held on to those, and all of this cumulative evidence comes up with a picture of a guy that was beyond broke. For one operational year, Donald Trump lost $50 million. Now that's some $44 million that he reported in losses that year, plus $5-something million that he had carried over from the year before. This was around the time that he was writing the book, The Art of the Deal. Oh, well, he was sitting by while another guy ghost wrote the book, The Art of the Deal. It's when Trump was trying to brand himself as this Hollywood-esque story of success and gumption and wealth. And even in interviews from that time, Trump used to say when it came to his own success that, you know, unfortunately in this country, the only measurement of that is money. And I got a lot of it. So I'm a good guy. I've done big things. Bigly things. Bigly wasn't out yet, but yeah. He drummed up himself a whole lot. And in the earliest year, I think it was 1987, that he showed up on the Forbes list, valued around, you know, $500 million in wealth. That actually included a lot of the properties that his father owned that Trump then double listed as his assets for the purpose of making the Forbes list. But when you look at his actual returns, he was losing money on hotels. He was losing money on his casino investments and from a lot of shops that he had put in various apartments. You know, kind of small-scale strip mall managing. Here's the thing. When you look into the real picture of Donald Trump on paper, it doesn't add up to Donald Trump on soundbite. Donald Trump on soundbite was the epitome of the 80s lifestyle, and in the 90s, the bullish attitude that this recession was just going to be temporary and we're going to be on top of the world, baby, once this whole thing with George H.W. Bush is over and we get a Democrat in the White House. Yeah. Trump went a completely different way politically back then. But political motivations aside, one of the things that he portrayed himself as was, I am a successful millionaire. I am a big deal. And as a big deal millionaire, I should be able to go around and, you know, sell my value to others. And a lot of the stuff that you see reporting as earning during these times when Trump was losing dozens of millions of dollars a year, one of the earnings, one of the rare earnings that you found in all of these transcripts was him basically speculating to other companies that he was going to buy them. So this is how it would happen. Trump would go out and basically say he was going to buy another company. Oh, I'm a rich, rich guy. I'm going to buy this company. Ah, look at me. I'm about to buy this company. Well, when you do that as the CEO of a corporation, guess what happens? People start to invest in your company thinking that you're about to make a major acquisition. So in a lot of times when Trump found himself in financial shortfalls, he would just go out and, I'm just going to say it as plainly as it is, lie about his intentions to buy another company so that people would throw money into his own. Now, of course, these were short-term windfalls. The Trump brand, after, you know, a couple of weeks of quote-unquote speculating over buying a business, once there was no movement, no negotiations, or anything seen to any outside investors, nor reports of any backdoor negotiations happening between Trump and whatever company he said he was going to buy, investments sharply dropped off, leaving Trump once again losing millions of dollars. Now, this is the thing. Trump has said time and time again that he doesn't pay taxes because he's a very smart guy. And as a very smart guy, well, very smart people know about your silly tax code. We can circumnavigate it all we want to. We can get away with paying no taxes. But it turns out if you look at the story behind the why did Trump pay no taxes, is it because he's a smart man or is it because of something else? You find out that it's most definitely the latter. It's something else. You see, by reporting these millions of dollars of loss from his own company, even in times when he was receiving outside payments and started to build a name for himself, licensing his name and likeness to products and eventually television and movie properties. Of course, everybody remembers The Apprentice. That's why everybody's fascinated with Donald Trump, a well-scripted, highly edited Donald Trump. But that's where the fascination came from. And he only got to that point because in all of his other business dealings, in the hotel business, the real estate business, the golf course business, the eateries business, the apartment shopping centers business, let's not forget, well, you know, everything else that Trump tried to do, Trump Towers, anyone? All of those entities were losing money. And as he was reporting these massive, massive losses on his tax returns that the New York Times has, because he was reporting these massive losses, he wasn't required to pay any tax. So if Donald Trump is a very smart man that knows how to circumvent the tax code, I've learned his secret. You have to be paper poor. You basically have to say, on every return, I am poor. Oh, and by the way, you better be able to back up the poor speak, because audits do happen. Not fictitious ones that Trump claims he's under, but yes, real audits do happen. So apparently if you're poor, you can get by the exact same way that the richest man to ever be president claims he is. Because time and time and time again, year after year after year after year, from the mid-1980s all the way up to the 1990s, on paper, it looks like Donald Trump was basically functioning in the red at all times and only generating money whenever he could license a small product here or there. It didn't have to be the best product. It just had to pay him for his name and likeness sometimes. And that's why the Trump brand, as far as all the products that he's launched, have all inherently failed. They were inferior products to begin with that just thought that they could catch a little gleam of ritziness by licensing this rich persona, this American success story of Donald Trump, even though he wasn't successful and he desperately needed the dividends from those likeness rights. Like, desperately. I mean, Donald Trump was reporting hundreds of millions of losses after the year 2000, at least from information that we know. So with all of these loss after loss after loss years under his belt, is he the successful paradigm that he claims to be? Not really. And unfortunately, it goes even deeper. Because remember how I said that these records are already under attack from the White House? Well, first thing, of course they are. And second thing, how dare they? But when it comes to their responses, they've started to evolve over time. You see, their first responses were somewhere along the lines of, well, you know, no, we're not going to tell you anything because he's the president. He has a right to a privilege, a executive privilege, something, something, something. And we just can't show you. Over time, that has evolved to basically the White House saying, you know what? Those records that you've obtained, and they're talking, of course, to the New York Times at this point, those records that you obtained aren't really binding. And, you know, they're probably full of terrible inaccuracies. That was before digital filing was invented. So, handwritten ledgers be damned. You know nothing. Well, that's where it gets very interesting. Because despite Charles J. Harder, he's the lawyer for the president right now, despite him saying that these tax returns are demonstrably false and these paper statements are absolutely in no way possible to be used in any sort of fact-finding way because they're so inaccurate. By the way, he cited no specific errors and didn't say where these inaccuracies could possibly exist. Well, that's when the New York Times dug up Mark J. Mazur. He's a former director of research, analysis, and statistics at the IRS. And he said, look, those paper documents that you've obtained and that you've verified are very, very much far away from unreliable. They are very reliable. The data that was used to create these transcripts has undergone several layers of bureaucracy quality control. For once, the whole rigmarole of government works for us. But that quality control set back in the time during these handwritten reports existed for a specific reason. Because the data that was contained in those tax returns were broken down into transcripts that IRS auditors could then turn into summaries. Now, these summaries would then be sent to Washington, D.C. and help establish economic policy and tax policies across the board. In other words, far from being unreliable, These were absolutely critical to how the United States Federal Reserve functioned and how the United States, well, government, Congress, and the executive branch thought about tax coding. One branch had to consider inflation, deflation, what is the the evaluation of the United States dollar, and the other one had to say, do we tax or not tax? And what do we do when we have short tax seasons where the government doesn't make anything and we're functioning in a deficit, and what do we do in surplus years? Now, with all of that said and done, the reliability of the document should absolutely be considered tantamount to how the United States economy functions. And if they are good enough for the United States government to look at and determine how we are taxed, how income functions in this country, well, and basically everything with money as far as the executive and legislative branch are concerned, if they find that data, oh, and by the way, to this day, they still from time to time go 3 and 4 decades back and look at these transcripts just to get a feel of where the United States economy is evolving. Where was it? Where is it? These things are critical to knowing that picture. So if they're good enough for us to put so much reliance on them in that sense, shouldn't we consider what the New York Times has found? And I encourage you to go read their story. It's called Decade in the Red. And it has quotes from Trump back in 1987 where he says, quote, there is no one my age who has accomplished more. At that time, he was actually very much functioning under a deficit. He was very paper broke at the time that he said that. So if accomplishing massive amounts of debt while deceiving the American public, as a real estate mogul at this time, in believing that that's not the case, then yes, you have accomplished more at that age than any other liar before you. But when you look into the story, when you start reading through it and you start unraveling the extent of research that went into it by the New York Times, the president is going to have a hard time claiming to be an American success story. And American success stories always kind of have dark turns, don't they? It seems weird, but every time we have an American success story, we also eventually learn that that person was, well, maybe not on the up and up. And that's where our last story finds us. I kind of want to do a follow-up here over the NXIVM sex cult. Now, we've talked in the past about Allison Mack's role in it. We've talked in the past about how even stars that we are familiar with where this show is broadcast in the state of Hawaii, you know, the stars of Hawaii Five-0. Well, one of them was involved in NXIVM's DOS program. Grace Park, by the way. We've been following this story for the longest time, and the last person to go to trial in this whole affair is the leader, Keith Raniere. And that happened in a Brooklyn courtroom where they started to hear yesterday opening statements about the sex trafficking and conspiracy charges against him. Now, prosecutors say that he oversaw the slave and master program. That's the one that we reference when we talk about Allison Mack and more. And that was eventually found to be called NXIVM. And there was sub-programs within NXIVM like DOS and others. Now, of course, Keith Raniere has pled innocent to all charges. He says he's not guilty. If he is convicted, he could face life in prison. And when you want to know about evidence stacked up against this guy, not only do we have the social media accounts of all the people that he was, well, let's just call it for what it is, brainwashing at the time to do his bidding. Not only do we have their whole profiles and what that profile means about who is talking or, in this case, controlling them, we have video footage of Keith Raniere. doing these questionable things. And if that evidence isn't enough, literally, we have women walking around with his initials burned into their, well, into their pubic area. Their pubis, as it was. The area, okay, well, look, I'm not going to explain anatomy to you. But it is something that you need to consider in this case. This is a guy that's pleading not guilty to some very, very horrible acts that literally left his victims branded for life. And over the next coming weeks, as the trial unravels in Brooklyn, I would like to check in with it. Because Keith Raniere is just like, oh God, this is going to be a very bad comparison. Keith Raniere's notoriety is just like Donald Trump's notoriety, in as far as he built up an entire empire of controls that defied outside checks and balances by lying to a small select group of people. Now, this included people that were involved with, well, all kinds of industries, including the Seagram's alcohol empire. Found to be, you know, the heiress of that was one of the chief financiers of NXIVM. And time again, personalities like a Raniere or Donald Trump captivate people in such a way that they bypass their logic centers, and even if it's not harm against somebody else, they allow harm to be done to them, despite every common sense instinct telling them not to. So that's why I always follow up on this story, and I'll continue to. And tomorrow, we'll get into the news and the week in review. Till then, love you, mean it. Gate in, bye.